if you're not like sucked into the kind of brainwashing and propaganda that is U.S. healthcare, that kind of just dehumanizes our people, it dehumanizes our patients and even healthcare workers. If you don't buy into that, you're radicalized in the sense that like people, the healthcare, U.S. healthcare system as it stands is, it's not healthcare, it's death care. It's just about death and destruction and profiting off of people's illness and suffering. So I saw that pretty early on when I started working as a registered nurse, and especially when I was working in the emergency rooms in New York City. It's the conditions are so horrific, and patients actually, and especially most especially low income patients, suffer great morbidity and mortality due to the inefficiencies of the U.S. healthcare system. And I was able to make those connections very, very early on in my career. We would often have up to 20 patients at a time, 20 critical patients. I don't know how one single nurse could take care of all of them at one point. And I became very radicalized in that line of work very quickly, and actually became a whistleblower about the hospital I was working at, because it was just so horrific to me. And then COVID happened in 2020, and I was working as an ER nurse then, and just saw the mass death that was happening from that, primarily Black and Brown communities, low income, and you know, rich people are always going to be able to get care and get health care. It's always the poor people that are going to be, you know, that are going to lose their lives because of not having access to health care, and that's currently the United States healthcare system.
Right, but I must say that I have full admiration for your line of job, and because I'm aware of the kind of sacrifices that you guys make, so I have to say that you mentioned the COVID area, era, and I know the kind of sacrifice. It was so hard for you guys.
It was crazy
to still be working in such conditions. So,
well, you know, on that note, that's always kind of, you know, seeing the complete demolition and decimation of healthcare infrastructure in Gaza. I don't understand how every single healthcare worker in the U.S. or all over the world is not just shouting about this, because it's desecrating. It's completely Israel and the United States has completely desecrated like just whatever medicine and you know healthcare is at this point. Like how can doctors and nurses not say that this is wrong? It's beyond me.
Jennifer Koenigs, it was a pleasure to talk to you and have you here on Soul.
Thank you.
And thank you for spending the time with us again on another Soul. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, back on the road.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans of the Sacred Defense and the resistance field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniyah on September 20th, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. Another achievement of the Sacred Defense was that it expanded our frontiers. I'm not speaking of its geographical borders. We do not seek to expand our geographical borders, neither at that time nor now. We are not seeking to expand our geographical borders. The Sacred Defense expanded our other frontiers, such as the frontier of resistance. This is an example. Today, the concept of resistance and the element of resistance is an established element. There's resistance in Palestine, there's resistance in West Asia, and there's resistance in various other countries. There's resistance in Iraq, there's resistance in Iran and in various places. The Sacred Defense raised and promoted the idea of resistance around the world. It established resistance in many parts of the world. We ourselves may find it hard to believe that the actions of the Iranian nation have had such an impact in distant countries, but they have had such an impact. We have information about this. I do not wish to name the countries. A large number of the Iranian nation's activities have served as a model for many people in the East, in Asia, in Africa, and also in Latin America. This is what expanding frontiers means. Our intellectual and cognitive borders have expanded. This is a nation's greatest success, to be able to expand its own culture, understanding, knowledge, and wishes in the world. This mainly took place by way of the Sacred Defense. The 8 years of the Sacred Defense worked miracles in this aspect. It spread the culture of self-reliance. Now, when we speak about resistance, we want to see whom this resistance is standing against. Our region, West Asia, is one of the regions that the world's power seekers have been focused on for various reasons. The powerful countries of the world have focused on this region and tried to interfere in it because of its resources, because of its geographical location, because of its being the center for Islam, and for multiple other reasons. Even now, we can see that the powerful countries interfere and intervene whenever they have the opportunity. The resistance is standing against these things. The culture of resistance against the domineering presence of powerful countries that have no right to be in this region has now spread widely. This is the reason why the issue of the presence of Iran in this region has angered the US and some other countries.
Jewish radio program.
Nakshijahan Square, one of the biggest and most beautiful squares in the world, a UNESCO World Heritage Site that must be on your bucket list.
Nakshijahan Square is located in the center of the city of Isfahan. It was built during the 17th century, during the Safavid era. This square, with its rich historical background, is one of the most spectacular attractions of the city of Isfahan.
On the western side of Nakshijahan Square, you find an exquisite palace which is known as Ali Kapu. It was built during the Safavid era and it was considered the political center of the country.
Ali Kapu literally means Great Gate. The palace is actually a six-story building, but you won't realize this until you go to the backyard. It was here that the Safavid king would entertain his special visitors. He also celebrated Nowruz, the Persian New Year.
We've just been to the palace. It's absolutely beautiful. We went up the staircase to the number of levels. We just saw the amazing decorative artwork. And then went up to the top chamber where we believe the musicians used to play, the amazing acoustics.
This amazing structure is rich in wall paintings. The doors, walls, and ceilings are highly ornamented with intricately designed floral motifs. On the sixth floor is where royal receptions were held and was referred to as the music hall.
One of the main attractions of Nakshijahan Square are the mosques that are located in it. Mosques that are not only considered masterpieces of Iranian Islamic architecture, but that are famous for their tile works.
Imam Mosque, also known as Jame Abbasi Mosque, is on the south side of the square. It is considered an excellent example of the Islamic era architecture of Iran. Its splendor is mainly due to the beauty of its seven-color tiles.
Probably the most amazing part of this mosque is its tile works. The tiles are so intricately designed that you can even find postcards and replicas of them around the square.
The magnificent tile work serves a double function. Aside from ornamenting the mosque, there was a need to weatherproof the simple clay bricks used in its construction. The tiles are decorated in seven colors, which is why they are called haftrang, which literally means seven colors.
It's absolutely beautiful. It's so big and colorful. And what else, Dan?
Yeah, the tiles and the decorations are amazing, aren't they?
You can find one of the most exquisite masterpieces of Iranian architecture, Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, which was built by Shah Abbas I of the Safavid dynasty.
What fascinates me most about this mosque is, first of all, architecturally it's a unique work. You don't have anything like that in any part of Iran or elsewhere, because it's a private mosque built for the father-in-law of Shah Abbas the Great.
I can't tell you enough about the beauty of Sheikh Lutfullah Mosque, but in my opinion, the most amazing part is the tile work under the dome. And if you're familiar with Persian carpets, you will find this design quite familiar. Isfahan is one of the oldest and largest bazaars in the Middle East. Some parts of it are more than 1,000 years old. The bazaar is abundant in handicrafts, so if you're looking for a little something to take back, this is where you need to go. Probably one of the most interesting parts of Nakhchivan Square is Qaisariya Bazaar, one of the longest bazaars in the world that connects Nakhchivan Square to Atiq Square. It's about 8 kilometers long. The square is still as vibrant as it was, today mostly with the presence of tourists rather than merchants, but is still reminiscent of its days of glory, when public ceremonies were held, nowruz was celebrated, and polo games were played. These amazing things, there's only one thing I can say. Visiting Nakhchivan Square must be on your bucket list.
Gizumi Shahmadi for Iran.
Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him, and he has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity,
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful, and may great peace and blessing be upon Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam and his household. Assalamu alaikum, my dear audience, brothers and sisters, and welcome back to the series of talks for humanity. I'm Hamza Azizi from IRIB English Radio. I'm sure you remember we've been talking about the Quranic teachings about the individual and personal attributes of human beings, regardless of his communications with other human beings or with whoever is around him. We are talking about the individual attributes of the ideal human being in Quranic point of view. Previously, we talked about several aspects, or let's say several attributes and ideal behaviors. We talked about at-tafakkur, thinking. We talked about gaining knowledge. We talked about working, trying, and we talked about the purity and impurity. And now, in this episode, we are going to start a series of talks about patience. Patience is one of the individual characteristics that human beings should have, and it's a kind of ideal merit of the human beings based on Quranic teaching. The issue of patience is a very quite comprehensive topic, and if we want to include and cover all the aspects of the patience mentioned in the Holy Book, that might take tens of episodes. We try our best to briefly touch this topic and try to open a new window and an eye-opening discussion about this issue. Let's begin with this point, that the great figures, great Quranic figures, who have been introduced to us in this holy book, all of them were of the people who partake of patience. They were so patient examples. In the Holy Book, we have the story of Ayyub. Prophet Ayyub was known as a patient person. Let's start our talks with the story of Prophet Ayyub after a short break.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, my dear audience, brothers and sisters, to the series of talks for humanity. I'm Hamza Azizi, and this is IRIB English Radio. We are talking about the Quranic individual characteristics, one of which is the patience. we said that the Quranic great figures, all of them, they possessed this quality in their personality. And one of the most known of them was Prophet Ayyub. Even in some languages, his patience turned to be a kind of symbol and a kind of proverb. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about his story very briefly in a specific passage in which he says that Rabbi inni massani ad-dur, it's exactly the middle or almost at the end of his story. But based on the history and historical accounts and our narrations, Prophet Ayyub had a very interesting and at the same time strange story. Throughout a specific period of time, he lost his children, then he got disease, then poverty, and because of his contagious illness, or even it might not be, maybe wasn't kind of contagious illness, but the people of his town, they kicked him and his wife out of the city because they spread a kind of rumor that Prophet Ayyub, along with his wife, they have a kind of contagious illness, so they didn't let them stay anymore in the city, so they used to live out of the city at the suburb, and then they were alone, poor, and during some specific days they lacked food. And just imagine a kind of family that lost most of his members, and then they got disease, and then they lost money, and then they lost food, and then they lost the people, the city, the normal life, an ordinary life that everyone deserves to have, such simple life. So at that point, according to our narrations, Shaytan tried a lot to convince Prophet Ayyub to make some, at least a single piece of complaint against Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. But as a matter of fact, Prophet Ayyub rejected this temptation of devil, and he only asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I'm in trouble. Rabbi inni massani ad-dur. And then happened what happened, that inshallah in the next episode we will continue this strange and interesting story of Prophet Ayyub, and to see what level of patience he partaked of. Thank you very much. Have a good time. Walhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi. 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 Salli ala Muhammad wa alihi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Good morning to you all. You are listening to Iran Radio from Tehran. We start this hour's lineup with our varied radio productions feature. That will be followed by Olima's speech. In this program, we broadcast excerpts from the speeches of well-known and reputable Islamic scholars. And after that, we have Viewpoint. The program presents an analytical roundtable discussion of various political and social issues of the Islamic world today.
A question. How deep is the influence of the fashion industry on societies?
You can see more and more fast fashion brands producing more and more clothes.
The fashion industry is one of the most labor-intensive industries.
How does fashion affect our lives and societies?
Have to take different types of drugs to stop them from eating. They want to give energy.
Fashion is all about disposability, about making things very quickly at bigger margins, not caring about the environment as such.
This is the endless drive towards profit.
Fashion is the second greatest environmental disaster.
Who are the fashion moguls who make decisions about the society by controlling the fashion industry? Many societies tend to consume products that might be unnecessary. In fact, they turn to such products just because of advertisements run by fashion designers. This is one of the major viewpoints put forward by the critics of fashionism. Moreover, some critics have gone beyond this and even claim that fashion is used as a tool for imposing cultures and certain lifestyles. Does the fashion industry compel people into materialism and consumerism? Which firms are behind the scenes of fashion markets, for example, in London? And how much is the profit they're looking for in the industry? Follow me to find the answers to these questions. The global fashion industry makes some $1,000 billion in revenue each year. However, this figure is extracted from official statistics. Perhaps the undocumented revenue made through smuggling exceeds this number. How big is the fashion industry? Tansy E. Hoskins, who previously worked as a model, wrote a book titled Stitched Up after she quit her job. In her book, she claims that the fashion industry is influenced by capitalism. Hoskins has a critical view toward the profit-oriented aspects of the fashion industry.
And I also wanted to get people to start looking at the fashion industry in a different way.
I think that fashion very much has to be seen as part of capitalism, and because that's the reason why, you know, goods are produced at such high volumes and why wages are driven down and down and down, and is to increase profits for multinational corporations. So for me, you can't separate fashion from capitalism.
Ms. Hoskins is not the only one in the world who takes a critical stance on the profiteering spirit of the fashion industry. Headquarters of the War on Want Institution in London, which organizes campaigns against unfair exploitation of workers in England. Today, I came here to visit Ms. Tulsi Narayan Sanami, who is an economy expert and an activist who has launched different campaigns against exploitation of workers. I asked Tulsi if she too believes that the fashion industry is influenced by capitalism.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the endless drive towards profits, regardless of the exploitation of workers, the human rights of workers, and the environmental impacts. And I think that absolutely is the cornerstone of our economic system, is the race for profits, you know, at the expense of everything else. And we really see this as an economic system gone mad.
How big do you think the fashion industry is, especially from an economic point of view?
So the global apparel industry has surpassed $1 trillion a year, and it's set to, by some estimations, double by 2025. So it's a rapidly growing industry, and you can see more and more fast fashion brands producing more and more clothes each year.
But who spins the wheels of this industry? To find the answer, we better ask people who work in the fashion industry. One of these people is Ms. Orsella Tikas, a renowned fashion and clothing designer in England. She is one of the founders of Fashion Revolution.
The fashion industry is one of the most labor-intensive industries in the world. It is considered to be the second most polluting industry in the world. It employs billions of people. 80% of the fashion workforce is female. It's huge. It has directly and indirectly an effect on something like 1 in 6 in the population are directly affected or employed by the fashion industry.
Is profit the only aspect that matters in the fashion industry, or does it pursue certain goals behind the scenes?
The fact that we stand a real chance right now to act so that it operates sustainably, so that it operates free from exploitation, so that garment workers are paid a living wage, so that the environment is protected. If we do all this now, we really stand a chance to have a huge, profound impact on people and planet.
I'm curious to learn about cheap and unethical fashion, which many are opposed to today. That is why I'm going to meet a fashion and clothing designer who is one of the founders of a campaign against unethical fashion.
Enormous influence on our lifestyle. I think fast fashion has changed our perceptions about fashion. Most importantly, it's really changed our idea of how much fashion should cost. So whereas 30 years ago, 50 years ago, you could buy, on average for the salary, you could buy a certain amount of clothes, now suddenly we're empowered to buy a huge amount more.
Ms. Orsella, too, criticizes the promotion of fast or unethical fashion. She believes capitalists try to promote fast fashion in order to persuade people into mass consumption.
Fast fashion takes its name from fast food. It implies a fashion that is ready, available, cheap, on demand, on your high street. Whenever you want it, there it is, you can buy it. The reality is that the fashion industry really is a lot about craft, about artisanship, about time, the time it takes to make clothes. And so fast fashion is in antithesis to what perhaps the craft of fashion is.
What it means is the idea of producing collections quickly and cheaply. And it's a very clever retail strategy in the end, because what it means is that shops can sell a lot more, make a lot more money, because psychologically for the consumer it's much easier to buy something at a low cost and buy lots of things than spend a lot at once.
While fast fashion is about delivery now, sustainable fashion, slow fashion, ethical fashion is about taking time. While fast fashion is quite invisible, you know, we don't know who makes the clothes, we don't know anything about the fast fashion supply chain. Sustainable fashion is the opposite. It's about identifying that supply chain, it's about making visible the people that make our clothes, it's about reintroducing the love of craft and handmaking.
The experts I spoke to believe unethical or valueless fashion is a means for profiteers, behind-the-scenes players, and economic powers. They believe economic powers in the fashion industry manipulate people's tastes and interests to lure them into adopting certain lifestyles or consuming certain commodities.
Fast fashion, where consumers are sort of addicted to buying the latest trends,
rid of those clothes because the next trend has come out, has really impacted the environment, especially the waste, garment waste. Because unfortunately, the garments that are being produced by mass manufacturers are not actually ethically produced, they're not sustainable. So they're impacting landfill sites. And we've got, and unfortunately, fashion is the second greatest environmental disaster.
Shamiza Rashid asked me to visit an exhibition to better grasp the difference between ethical and unethical fashion. This small expo was held somewhere in London by an independent designer with the aim of promoting ethical fashion. Ms. Aisha Mustafa is a fashion designer and a severe critic of fast fashion. Although this is a small exhibition, the organizer tries to show that even ordinary needs for clothes can be met using ethical fashion. For example, the producer of these items has not tried to exploit cheap workers or produce cheap but low-quality products, which will only lead to mass consumption and environmental pollution.
Fast fashion is all about disposability, about making things very quickly at bigger margins, not caring about the environment as such.
Aisha and other experts I talked to about ethical fashion believe that the majority of people don't pay attention to where the products they consume come from and how they're produced. So I decided to ask some of the passers-by around one of London's shopping centers about this issue.
No, because those people are earning a living and, you know, if they weren't making it, somebody else would, so.
Not really, no.
I looked to see where it was made, yes.
Some people would like to know about the country of origin of the products, rather than the manufacturing companies.
They're coming in
from China, mostly. China, Bangladesh, kind of this country. Well, their labor is cheap there.
Some of those who work in this industry purchase cautiously, like this woman.
Well, I've worked in the textile industry, so I do see where these things come from.
Or this one.
Yes, usually I do, yes. I'm actually studying fashion, so I study, you know, the place of origin, how it matters, and sweatshops, and the whole Bangladesh, Rana Plaza thing, so yeah.
It's interesting that women who work in the industry say they use a clothing item for a long period of time.
How long do you use this item? Usually one season.
As long as it lasts, really.
But others have a different opinion.
For Primark, maybe it could just 2-3 months.
It depends. Usually the clothes lady doesn't take it that much long. They change it.
Hello?
Quite a while. Yeah, depending on what it is.
Over and over and over again, lots.
I think there's an increased awareness about these things because of the press coverage and the media. And I think now, before we throw a piece of garment, we actually, there's an awareness.
However, statistics show that the frequency of purchase of clothes is increasing. It can be understood that profiteers take advantage of this trend in the best possible way to promote fast fashion. But the promotion of fast fashion entails some requirements for its investors. Sometimes investors do whatever it takes to comply with these requirements. One of the outcomes is the psychological destruction of young models. Many of these models spend years grappling with the debilitating effects of working in the fashion industry. Some of the models manage to survive these conditions after spending a critical period. I found it necessary to speak to one of these victims, who used to be a model and currently works as an expert in the field. One of the experts I'm going to talk to is Ms. Karima Bentaoui. She used to be a model, and in the year 2000, she converted to Islam.
I think that most young girls, they really want to be in fashion because they think it's really glamorous, exciting, you know, like they see lots of magazines and pop videos, and they want to be like that girl because they think that girl's getting lots of attention. And I started off as a makeup artist, so that really was behind the camera. And for me, it was more about the money and the travelling. It wasn't about the attention. So that's how I got into working as a mannequin for 4 years in Zurich, in Cologne, in Dusseldorf, in Paris and in London, but that was a long time ago, alhamdulillah.
What's your opinion about the behind-the-scenes business?
Well, it's not good really at the end of the day, because as a beautiful woman, there's a lot of men who want you to be with them, and they want you to be with them as a fashion accessory. Basically, your fashion accessory. They've got a nice watch, they've got nice Mercedes, and so they have to have a nice girl sitting in the car. It's the picture. They want the picture. And a lot of the times, as a girl, you're not really, because the mentality is immature, is you're not really aware of what is going on.
Fashion modeling, structurally, has the same kinds of characteristics as other kinds of jobs that sociologists actually call bad jobs, like precarious workers in flexible fields, day laborers even, people who don't know when their next paycheck.
Ms. Ashley Myers is another former model who lives in the U.S. She is the author of a book titled Price and Beauty. In the book, she shares her experiences in the world of fashion and the conditions of modeling. She has revealed facts from behind the scenes of the industry.
Fashion modeling is an occupation that actually kind of pushes the way we can think about careers versus jobs. I mean, it's a series of jobs, but the career itself is very unstable, very short-lived. Most models are finished by the age of 24, 25 for women, a little bit longer for men. It's similar to occupations like sports, the kinds of markets where people sell their bodies.
If you pay a visit to shopping centers in metropolitan cities, you will see products that are the same in quality and are sold at dramatically higher prices. But where, how, and by who are these expensive brands manufactured? In 2013, the deadliest industrial incident occurred in the fashion industry, where the Rana Plaza building in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka, collapsed.
In April 2013, there was a six-story building in Bangladesh, just in the outskirts of Dhaka, and despite the fact that it was clear that the building was unsafe, the workers had spotted cracks in the building the day before. They were ordered to re-enter the building and continue working.
1,138 people were killed, and hundreds more were injured. Search and rescue operations lasted for a month in the hope of finding possible survivors under the rubble. Around half of the victims were female workers, whose children were kept in the same building. The products of some of the most renowned brands were manufactured in this factory.
It was a predictable disaster. Many of us kind of, you know, almost tragically waiting for it to happen. There had been others. There had been the Tazreen fire only, you know, 1 year before, in which hundreds of people died. So it was inevitable. It is a symptom of broken chains. It is a symptom of an industry that has lost common sense and that has lost any sense of transparency. You know, many brands who actually were operating even know that they were operating in Rana Plaza, and many brands that didn't produce in Rana Plaza thought that maybe they were producing in Rana Plaza.
The fashion show, or the fashion week, is held annually in early January in the U.S. and Europe. The fuss and fanfare of the fashion week are associated with some unfavorable dimensions, which usually go unnoticed. One such adverse aspect is the exploitation of tailors and workers of the fashion industry who work in the toughest conditions in countries like Cambodia, India, Bangladesh, and Thailand.
It's a significant issue, and it's an issue that is very much demonstrative of neocolonialism. This is, you know, we've seen the endless extraction of labor and mineral wealth from these countries for the benefit of colonial countries, and this in many ways is an extension of that. And I think the fact that it's normalized is in many ways representative of that understanding that we can expect less for the lives of people in the global south.
Primark, Chanel and Nula were among the prominent brands produced in the Rana Plaza. The shop that you see behind me belongs to Primark, which has hundreds of branches around the world. In recent years, this brand has made rapid advances. Primark finally surrendered to the pressures exerted by the media and ethical fashion activists and was forced to pay £6 million to the survivors of the Rana Plaza incident. Despite many efforts, the authorities of this company rejected my requests for an interview.
This has been going on for a very, very long time, child labor, and it's extremely unfortunate. There needs to be more regulation on how the companies, overseas companies, when they are the manufacturers, and who is actually being employed.
The collapse of the Rana Plaza ignited protests against the fast, unethical fashion. Initially, the rallies were limited to the collapse of the building, but then they rapidly snowballed into bigger movements, such as fashion revolution. Ms. Orsella is one of the pioneers of this international campaign.
What do you mean by fashion revolution?
Fashion revolution wants to see an industry that values people, profit, the environment,